This year, like every year, the Wayside Chapel will be hosting a big Christmas lunch and street party in Sydney's King's Cross. Over 1,000 meals, with all the trimmings, will be served to homeless people and locals. Graham Long is the pastor and the CEO of the Wayside Chapel, and he's back with us on Conversations Today. Wayside helps more than 300 people every day of the year. Many of them arrive in bad shape. Some are more or less on their knees through addiction or homelessness, domestic violence or mental illness. Wayside's philosophy is simple. They see everyone who comes to them as a person to be met, not a problem to be solved. At Wayside, people can have a shower, get a hot meal, sometimes a clean set of clothes, and be sent in the direction of other services to get help. And while sometimes the Wayside Chapel is able to get those people on their feet, there's also many people who don't make it through intact or even alive. We spoke with Graham Long in 2016 about his own life story, and I've asked him back today to talk about a typical day in the life of the Wayside Chapel. Hello, Graham. Welcome back, sir.
I can hardly wait to see what a typical day might be.
You've never reflected on it, I wonder.
Well,
here it is. First thing in the morning, you wake up, and what kind of messages are waiting for you as soon as you wake up?
Actually, there is a bit of a routine in the morning, actually, before I get cracking, because my phone always has messages from Messenger and Facebook, that kind of thing. And it's just easier to deal with that first thing in the morning. I turn the phone off so I can sleep. You know,
isn't that nice?
Yeah, I know. Sleep has to happen. Right. But at about, I don't know, somewhere between 6 and 7, I turn it on and I just deal with what's come. And there's a lot of messages always come through the wee hours. And, you know, I had one just the day before yesterday, a lady who I knew, I don't know the lady, but she wanted to reconcile with her husband, and I know she was interstate. She said, "I'm pregnant and I haven't been with a man." So I text back and said, "Sweetheart, you've chosen the right time of year to run that story, but I don't think it's going to work."
Baby in a manger and all that.
Then I felt terrible because what she meant was she'd been raped. You know, she hadn't been with somebody, and it resulted in a pregnancy and so on. And another one was a youngish, very beautiful woman who I've met once, and she's just gorgeous. But she said she'd had some kind of revelation from God and had decided she was going to go off her meds. And I said to her, "Oh, please, honey, do it with medical supervision, whatever you do." And she promised me she would. Well, later in the day, I got another message from her saying, I went to the emergency department of one of the hospitals in Sydney, and she said, "I've only just realised how unwell I am." So that was a really, thank God that worked that way. And now she's getting treatment, and I think she's on a road to recovery. So,
how many messages typically will you wake up to, if there is a typical figure?
I tell you, when I retire one day, I'm getting off Facebook. I don't get sick of people, but I don't really get the social media thing because I'm relating to people all the time I don't actually know. So, look, I don't know. There's a dozen, I guess.
A dozen? Yeah. More or less every morning.
Yeah.
The thing about social media too is that you can easily be misconstrued.
Yeah.
And it's better to talk most of the time, I'm
sure. It's very difficult.
Each one of these sounds like they're a bit like an unexploded bomb.
Yeah, because you know, the most complex things come in a text that truly would take you a long time to unpack it. Like the one I really stuffed up when I said, you know, you've chosen the right time to run this story. Well, you know, there was a serious and heart rending story that I just kind of made fun of. She forgave me for it, but you know, that's the kind of traps that just come at you.
Last week there was a young mum and dad with a newborn. Can you tell me that story?
Yeah, there's a beautiful couple who found out just I think 2 weeks before the birth of their child that the child would not live long. They had a very odd DNA combination that meant this child was going to die early from birth. They asked me to be in the room as the baby died, and they nursed this baby, and you know, with every cell in their being, they wanted this baby to live, and the baby looked perfect. They stroked the little boy with their fingers, and the mum sang him sweet songs, and eventually his life ebbed away. And the incredible honour it was to be in that room. I felt like I received something, even though we lost this little boy. But the trust these people put in me to just be there and be a tower of weakness for them.
A tower of weakness? What do you mean?
That's what I do. A tower of weakness. I don't have magic tricks, you know. I don't know anything. I'm just there. And I was there with these people in this awful moment. And in some ways, I think they invited me in because they knew I wasn't going to tell them this all happened for a good reason. But I was just with them. And the trust they put in me was, man, one of the treasures of my life. And we lost the little baby.
I think I'd be terrified to walk into that room. Do you have to steel yourself before you do it?
I'm conscious that I walk on holy ground, that I have no right to be there, but that they would ask me to be there is just an honour beyond words. I've had two of those in just the last couple of months.
And that call for help arrived first thing in the morning for you?
I forget how. I think it might have been the day before when they knew this was going to happen and they asked if I could be with them. I forget now. And then we had a little memorial just, I forget when, a day or two ago, for this little baby, and all their families gathered in a park, and we lamented the loss of this little baby. It was very moving.
Yeah, I was going to talk about this a bit later on, but I was watching this new Netflix series called Godless, and it ends this with this incredible scene where the preacher finally arrives in town to speak at a funeral, and he quotes, I discovered later this is actually from a medieval Jewish poet, but he has this amazing line. The preacher says, "It's a fearful thing to love what death can touch." What do you think of that?
I think we kind of live in a very... we mostly live lives that are insulated from death. And so it's shocking to us. In fact, I think death's nothing much to be afraid of. It just is. And there's something... this is hard to talk about because people think we might be getting dark and depressed. And to me, there's nothing dark and depressing about this. The truth is life is fluid. We live just moments, really. It's funny how when you get old, you realise how fast it's going. When you're young, it's just crawling. I had a little five-year-old granddaughter, just turned five, and we had a big countdown for the five, and she knew that on that day none of her four-year-old clothes were going to fit, and so on, so on. Big, big countdown. Finally, we got to the day. I said, "Sweetheart, you've made it. You're five." And she dropped her shoulders, and she said, "So many sleeps till I'm six." What I love is how, as a kid, every moment lasts a lifetime. And then when you get to be an old bloke like me, a whole lifetime's just a moment. And you realise that kind of it's so fluid and you've only got a minute and death's just around the corner. And when you know that, you live better. It's not depressing at all. It's not something to be afraid of.
Yeah, I don't see it as depressing. I see it as something. I think there's fear around that rather than depression, because the death of an infant is so tragic. You fear your composure and your sense of self might shatter against the tragic fact of that death. Isn't that it? Rather, it's fearful. I mean, we might use the word depressing. It's not, depressing is like something you keep trying to do and fail at.
Yeah.
But this is more fear of being shattered, I think, by the tragedy of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess that's right. I think given, you know, we know how flexible time is, we know it's not a constant. This little baby lived his whole life on his mother's breast while they sang to him. And we felt like, wow, this kid's been ripped off. But I don't think that's how he felt. He lived his whole life being loved to the very last moment.
This is where we are in this program, and we haven't even got you arriving at work yet.
I thought this might happen.
So you get to work around about 9 a.m. at the Wayside Chapel in Hughes Street, Potts Point / King's Cross. Mm. What's normally going on around the door when you get there at 9 a.m.?
Oh, there's a lot of people hanging around. There's always a lot of people. And just saying hello and getting through the front door can be an effort. Like, everybody wants to say hello. So, you know, it can be 20, 30 minutes sometimes just trying to get in or out of the building. And, you know, I like that, actually. It's just people want to shake hands or say hello or hello, Father, or, you know, whatever it is. And can you lend me $2 or, you know, can you lend me $1,000? My lady just said the other day, can you lend me $1,000? I said, honey, $1,000? Are you kidding? She said, well, you drive a Mercedes. I said, I do not. I've been once in my life in a Mercedes. She said, I've seen you. It's a convertible. You've got one. I said, no, sweetheart, I haven't got one. Trust me, I haven't got one. And then she said, well, you own this building, looking at the Wayside building. And look, there's incredible conviction amongst homeless people that I own this. You know, that I built it and that it's mine. So they all think I'm filthy rich.
Multi-billionaire Graham Long, yeah, property developer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually pretty modest. I mean, I used to live around the corner from the Wayside and I used to walk past it all the time. And I suppose people who haven't seen it might be imagining a sweet little conventional church, but it's not like that.
Nothing like that at all, no. And we've rebuilt it and it's a beautiful, functional kind of building because we do lots of things in it. And it's, you know, it's great, but it's just funny that a lot of homeless people think it's mine.
Once you're there in the building and you're dealing with those people who need things, you know, food or help or something, or $1,000 for whatever, something. Tell me about the shift that sometimes takes place in people.
Well, look, most people have come on the worst day of their life, and when your life is imploding, you are usually driven by a question which can be summarised as, what can you give me? And look, there's a related question. You don't have to be homeless. There's a related question, which is, how do I get the most for the least? You know, and that's a question that drives you when your life is shrinking. And we know that a miracle is about to take place when a shift happens, which is indicated by the driving question begins to become, how can I help? And when you hear that, you know, here's someone who's on their way to life.
How does that shift take place? How long can it take? And is this the work of weeks, months, years?
I wish I knew. We don't have the faintest idea. We can't make it happen. It just, the biggest danger on our part is that we get so busy managing people that we don't meet them. And we don't see this shift, but you have to stay awake because sometimes it's just a glint in the eye that wasn't there yesterday, or maybe it's today I'm sick of being sick, whatever it is, but there's a shift that does take place, and if you see it, you can see that people want to be part of something that's bigger than themselves and of their own motive, they want to move towards health. And, you know, it happens over and over. And then the change you see is truly transformative because it's not driven by us. It's not us who want an outcome. It's the person themselves who wants to live.
So this is quite self-directed then?
Absolutely it is, of course. Yeah.
And what's the Wayside's role then? I mean, to sustain them or set an example or what?
To meet, to be there and to meet. Because the truth is, when you realise that there's more to you than just being the individual you, you will naturally move towards health. You'll want to move. You want to move your feet. You want to do more. You want to be part of something bigger. You want to make a contribution to the community. And when that happens, it really does happen. People move towards health under their own steam. It's not because we have a tricky 7-step answer that we worked out of, you know, some helping book or the Bible or anywhere else. You know, it just isn't there. All there is your humanity and mine. And when we discover that my humanity is made by yours and yours by mine, that we're either saved or lost together, you know, I often say to people, I'd rather be lost with you than saved without you.
So does that person need to be well before they ask that question, how can I help? Or is asking that question, the way to being well.
It's the asking the question indicates that they're on the way. And the way isn't, it's never a case of, oh, we flicked a switch, now we're on a, you know, now we're healthy. It's always three steps forwards, two steps back, three steps forward. But if when that is sustained over time, it only takes a matter of months and you are left saying, wow, look at this. Wow, what a life.
What can you give to that person who's arriving in a state of pain of some kind or another?
Not much. Not much. If they come and they're driven by, what can you give me? You know, we haven't got a lot to give. It's a bit like when my son was little, I used to bribe him every day. I'd come home, you know, Robin would do all the hard work, but I'd always have a toy or a lolly or something. And I came home one day, I'd been really busy, and he's rifling through my pockets looking for something. And I said, oh, sweetheart, Dad hasn't got anything today. All I've got's love. And of course, he threw the biggest fit known to mankind. And,
is that all?
But, you know, that's us, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, what we want is the lolly. We don't want life. We don't want love. That's what we have to offer is largely disappointing if what you want's lollies. You know, love is a great letdown if your heart is set on lollies. So, you know, we're frustrating to people. If you arrive thinking this is an intensive care unit so that we can make you feel better in your lostness, you know, this is very disappointing because we're not here to meet all your needs. We're here to meet you and to call you out into a healthier place, which is a place of community where you take responsibility for yourself. In other words, you are responsive to others. And that's a much more difficult journey than just give me this, just give me that.
So you might be able to provide a shower, a meal,
yep,
a set of undies or something like that.
Yeah.
Perhaps. Sometimes it's simple as that.
Nothing says I love you like a clean pair of undies.
And to be perfectly honest, it's a tiny bit easier to bring them from lostness into community if they do have that clear pair of undies on, doesn't it? Quite frankly.
We don't do much for free, but we certainly give you a shower and a set of undies for free.
Do you think everyone can be drawn out of their lostness into community? Can everyone? Can that be done for everyone?
Yes, and everyone can dive into lostness, whether you are homeless or insanely rich. You know, it's possible to be living as if you're the only one in the world. And, you know, there's no fate worse than being constantly the smartest person in the room. You know, we are all invited to life all the time. You know, life is on offer everywhere. It's just a case of whether you see the invitation or not.
Can you offer them a different sense of who they are sometimes?
Just as they offer me a sense of who I am.
Ah.
Because everything I know about me has come from others. And when there is good news, it's always two-way. You know, a little bit of Grahamness rubs off on you and a little bit of Richardness rubs off on me. You know, that's the truth of the matter if it's going to be real.
Then there's the kind of prosaic business of you being the CEO as well as the pastor. We talked about the pastor. What? How about the CEO? How many staff you got there these days?
We've got 100 staff, maybe a few more than that, which is rather dramatic because it was just a handful years ago. So it's been rather dramatic. But, you know, the staff turn out to be human beings as well. You know, they are people who are sometimes insecure and think they need to make their case so that we'll be convinced that they're worthwhile. And, you know, staff, like human beings everywhere, have to learn to overcome, firstly, their own damage, and in the case of the staff, also their own damage and their training. Because they train hard and they learn skills and they read books and they think, well, now I must know things and I must have this repertoire of things that's going to make the world a better place. And it takes a long time for them to work out there's no repertoire, there's just your humanity and mine, that's all. And, you know, these people you're meeting are not clients, they're actually human beings, they've all got names. You know, just call them that.
Who are the staff you describe as those who jump the counter?
Yeah, Wayside's an unusual place because people who come in through the front door, even on their hands and knees as people in need, can jump the counter and become staff persons. Now, that may not sound rather startling, but you tell me any other agency where that happens. It doesn't happen. In fact, most of our tuppenny, halfpenny, pathetic professionalism is geared to make sure it'll never happen. You be the client, I'll be the expert, and we've got a desk to separate us. And that makes sure that nobody's going to be jumping any desks. So we do our best to overcome all of that. And that's what I mean about needing to overcome your training. So
you're saying then the best, sometimes you can fall into the trap if you're behind the counter of saying, look, I need to sort of draw up as much kind of pseudo authority as I possibly can in order to get the desired outcome, which is for you to take my advice.
Yeah, are you surprised? It turns out the frailty is the same on both sides of the desk. It just is true. And we have to find our own humanity as much as anyone who's coming through in great need. So our own humanity means I put aside all this nonsense and realise the biggest gift I can give you is to be present here with you as me.
You've got a woman working who's behind the counter, who's jumped the counter, who came in wearing a veil, or came to you in a veil. Tell me about her.
Gorgeous young woman who came from a lifetime of abuse and then was had an arranged marriage. She met her husband 30 minutes before the wedding. That ushered her into even more devastating abuse. Her life degenerated to the point where she thought death is the only way out and decided to burn the house down with her husband in the house. Now, when I met her, she thought she could well be facing attempted murder charges. She couldn't look anybody in the eye. She was veiled. And she was burned, she was just a frightened, shaking rabbit. And she was in a women's refuge. She came to Wayside to one of our little church services, and she had no Christian background or any kind of religious background.
Well, she wasn't Muslim then.
No, she was. I think she may have had a Hindu background, maybe.
So why the veil?
Because she was burned. She burnt this house down, and she got badly burned herself. And so this was hiding her facial burns, and she had those body bandages that came right to her wrists and down her legs and so on. I didn't know that. She knew she was totally covered and that she couldn't look at me. And she asked me to pray for her, which I thought was pretty interesting. So without knowing much of the story, I held her hands and I prayed Isaiah 43, which was, "Fear not, I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. When you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you'll not be burned. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One, and you are precious and honoured in my sight, and I love you." And now, I didn't know she was burned.
You didn't know she was burned at that stage, right?
No. But in fact, it's at the time, I didn't think any great thing was going on. But within weeks, the transformation in this woman was just remarkable. And really, this is someone you need to interview because she is so dynamic and articulate. She studied. She got a job in no time at all. She got promoted. She got promoted again. She saved money. She bought a car. She got herself housed. Now she's working for us because and she's just infectious. So if you meet her, you're more alive within 5 minutes.
You said she might have been facing a murder charge. What happened there?
It was dropped. Yeah, I don't understand the mechanics of it all, but there were no charges.
And what does she do in the Wayside Chapel now?
She works in our toughest part. So at the front desk, everything that you can imagine could happen at King's Cross happens. And she's a little tough cookie. And she loves people and she's so present and so able to meet people in their worst day that she's worth $1 million. I'm not paying her $1 million, but she's worth it.
Well, not from your massive property portfolio. I suppose she can answer that question too, which I imagine you might hear in that position, which is, what do you know about suffering? She's known suffering.
Yeah, and she knows the journey back to life.
On air, online, and podcast, you are listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
Now, you've got a community educator with a story who's working at Wayside. Tell me a bit about this man, please, Graham.
Rob was probably, I would say, one of the most dangerous fellows who lived on the street. He used to wear a bandana, a big South African guy, and he was violent. He said to me once, I couldn't tell you, Graham, how many thumbs I broke when I was on the street. And I knew he was a nasty kind of guy, or an intimidating guy. It turns out that he had been trained in the South African Army. He came to Sydney around about Olympics time to help train in anti-terrorism techniques, that kind of thing. He's quite a highly skilled fellow, actually. Then he got a job with a very big corporate, and drinking was getting the better of him, and he was hiding alcohol around the place and eventually sleeping overnight in his workplace and then making it look like he'd been home and so that he could drink through the night. And they woke up to it, sacked him, and he was on the street. And that meant he lost his marriage, he lost his three kids, he lost everything but a car, really. He still had a car. So he eventually ran a hose from his exhaust into his car, not far from us, and attempted suicide. He made a fairly good attempt because he was in hospital for a long time, and then he was sectioned after that. And then the day he was released, he walked back to Wayside and sat in front of me and said, "Oh, Paul, stop," you know, this big South African accent. He said, "You better pray for me." And I thought, well, how else can I get you out of the room?
You're scared of him, were you?
Look, I would say I rarely recognise what is moments of the most drastic change. It's just a moment. And you find out after the event it turned out to be a moment of radical change. This guy disappeared. I don't know where. And it turned out that he detoxed himself. He bought a two-man tent, went up the mountains and detoxed himself. And he used to catch a train back to us to have a shower each day and then head back up to live in his tent to detox himself. And he said, "Your shower was so important to me. It was the only place in the world I could cry." So for the loss of marriage, loss of children, loss of job, loss of everything. Anyway, 8 months later, I'm walking down towards Wayside and this big bloke came running up the street at me. And I thought, God, I hope this is friendly. And it was Rob. And he threw his arms around me and said, "I haven't had a drink from that day to this day." And he quickly shifted to, "How can I help?" And so we got him working in all sorts of different ways. We helped him into employment, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, we eventually had him in employment here with us, and he does our corporate education now. This same guy is still a big presence, but he now fills a room with life.
You know, what is corporate education?
Oh, he gets corporate groups to visit Wayside. He gives them a spiel about our work and what we do and so on. Then he walks them around our neighbourhood and explains what other people do in King's Cross. Then he brings them back. He gets them to cook lunch, and then they have to have lunch with homeless people. And it's really great for us because we're making new friends, and it's great for the corporates who arrive having lived in a world where the size of your desk is a big issue, and
nothing counts other than returning value to shareholders.
They look at these homeless people and they just think, "Why don't you work hard like me?" You know, and that's how their world is at the beginning of the day. And by the end of the day, they're quite grounded. They see, oh gosh, these are just human beings, and this could be me. And the fall into homelessness is rather easy. And they leave us by about 3 in the afternoon, and they've got a much bigger, wider hold upon the world.
There'll be better leaders after that, I've thought,
yeah,
too.
That
would definitely be the case. But is Rob your guy, the corporate educator guy, I suppose he's able to speak their language, corporate language to them.
Yeah, he's...
And it is like that now, isn't it, sadly?
He can speak the roughest of the rough, and he can speak with the corporates. And the genuineness of his story, he often shares his story. I worry sometimes about how many times this guy does share his story, but the genuineness of this story just hits you. You just know there is no horseshit involved in this at all. It's very hard not to be sucked into his presence because he's so alive and so happy to be alive.
And what do you want these corporate people to do for you? Donates? Volunteer? Or what?
Well, we charge them. That's the first thing. We don't do this for free. They pay I forget now that it's a couple of $1,000 or something, but they pay for that day. But we also harvest these people into our database, and we make friends. And so, we always reckon make friends, get people to love what we do, ultimately money follows. It's to fund what we do. So, that's a process whereby we're making new friends.
We're talking about, as if there is such a thing, a typical day in the life for you at the Wayside Chapel. What happens around late afternoon, getting into early evening at the Wayside?
Actually, we change gears in what we call twilight. So we actually run till about 10:30, 11 at night, something like that. But after about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, actually, if you haven't found a bed for the night, you're not going to. And so we start to give out warm clothes if it's cool and that sort of thing. And then after five, all other helping agencies around the place are shut. So we can't help you with bureaucracy. We can't help you organise all the things that go wrong when your life falls to pieces. So we have this thing called twilight. We employ people, not necessarily because they're social workers, but we're happy with jugglers and photographers and musicians and all that kind of thing. And in our twilight hours, which is really from 5 on or 4:30 on, the whole point of what we do is to just engage you. These used to be our worst hours, and they're now our best. We have bingo games and people take bingo so seriously. There's a prize worth $5, and people come to me and say, "We reckon this is rigged."
Sometimes when the stakes are so low, that's when the competition gets the most intense. And I don't know why that is.
It's just about engagement. That's all it's about. And I'm so proud of the people who do that late shift because they've transformed the place.
When I lived in that part of Sydney myself, I'd be happy to walk around any part of it most days, except around pretty much exactly where you are and around those streets, those back streets behind the cross.
Yeah.
After 3 a.m. on a Saturday night,
yeah,
or Friday night, because that's when there'd be groups of young guys who were drunk, who'd come to the cross looking for something and hadn't got what they were looking for,
yeah,
and were pretty much looking for a fight at that point. What do you do at that time? Do you batten down the hatches a bit and try and let that roll over you, or what?
Actually, we're shut, although the government would like us to be open 24/7, but we're shut at 11, and we're not open again till 9. But the cross has changed through these early closing laws, and there isn't that same... those young people that you were afraid of were not locals.
They were suburban people who
were tanked before they arrived at King's Cross anyway, and then just kept going. Well, that's largely lost, and in a way, it's a little bit sad. But that the good part of that vitality has all moved to Newtown. That Newtown is jumping, and the Cross is way more dead than it used to be.
How often do you find people arrive at Westside who are broken by heartbreak, the death of love, the end of a relationship?
That's just about everybody. When your life's imploding, there's a spiral. There's a momentum to it, and loss of relationships, loss of everything. It just one thing builds to another. And so most people have burned their bridges, actually, by the time we've got them. There's family who've tried and given up. And, most people are not believing love is possible, except in the sense of if we use love in all sorts of ways, and there's a selfish way of saying I love you, and it means I want you. It's the same as what are you going to give me? It's that shift, you know. It's the early version of that is how can you either make me feel better or how can I use you? And that's what they mean by love. So when the miracle happens, when the shift happens, then you start to be capable of saying, what can I do for you?
Where does the love live then? Where does that exist?
Oh, yeah, look. One of the sad things about the culture we live in is we think things like love, things like resilience, things like, you know, all kinds of personal qualities reside in me. And it is so profoundly misunderstood, because the truth is, there's no such thing as a single human being. There is no such thing. The word I could only ever describe half of something. The truth is, I'm not complete till there's at least two of us. And my center is not in here. It's not in here. My center is between you and me. And while I live as an individual, I never know who I am. I can't know who I am. It's only when I truly engage with you that I begin to find out who I really am. You might say, in a certain sense, you complete me. People who fall in love say that. But it's true in every relationship when you meet. You know, we are completed by the other. And you learn who you are through the other.
Are people wanting to hear that, or don't want to hear that, or longing to hear that, or just don't want to hear that? Or what's your understanding of that idea?
I think people are longing for it and they fight it off. You know, they think they're so hardened and so damaged that they think, if you show friendship toward me, there must be an ulterior motive, therefore I'll box it off. And it's a very hard thing to see that someone is with me and for me. It's a very difficult thing to see. But it's miraculous when it's seen.
You know, very often in movies, love, where people fall in, or love is used to transfigure an individual. You know, that's the thing, isn't it? It's a process. It brings about a kind of individual metamorphosis. It's not the same thing as the kind of thing you're talking about. That thought has just occurred to me.
Well, love, faith, whatever word you want to use, we have to see that when we meet on a narrow ridge, and on one side is an abyss called individuality. If you fall into that abyss, everyone you meet is only either useful to you or makes you feel better. And the other abyss, on the other side, is what I would call collectivity. It looks like community, but it's really based on we hate those people. And you know, it's, you know, like the Nazis, you know, that looked like solid community, but it was based on we hate those people over there. So it's quite deceptive. Yeah. So, and I think of the two, the collectivity is more lonely even than the individuality. Yeah. But, you know, on this narrow ridge, we meet one another, and that's how love works. That's how faith works. Love isn't a feeling. It just drives me dingbats when I hear people talking about love as an inner feeling. It's ridiculous.
You do funerals too, Graham.
Of course.
There was a man you buried recently who'd been really lovely to you after your son had died. Yeah, tell me about this man.
When my son died, I went into kind of autopilot mode. People were offering me holiday houses and everybody was beautiful to me. But I needed to be in the routine of Wayside because that's just what I needed. It's how we all grieve differently. Anyway, I was running late for a meeting. I suddenly realised I was running late. And I bounded down the stairs and I came towards the front door, and one of the shabbiest looking homeless men I've ever seen in my life, which is really saying something.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Well, see, this man had a skin disease, which you could see from the minute you saw him. It was beyond shabby. It was very unwell, really. And when I got to know him, you could walk with him and see that he was leaving a cloud behind him. You know, the skin just left him. It was incredible, terrible disease.
It's a psoriasis, was it, or something?
Well,
if it was,
it's the worst form I've ever seen. He would pull up his pants sometime and scratch his legs and come up with a pile of skin the size of a tennis ball. So, you know, we're talking pretty serious disease.
That sounds like leprosy.
When I first met him, he's in this doorway, and and he's stopping me, get out of the building. So I was kind of veered to the left, and he moved to block me, so I veered the other way because I wanted to get in a cab to block me. And eventually we're face on, and he's looking at me with this really goofy look on his face. And I thought, $2, you know, that fixes nearly everything. So I'm rifling through my pockets, and he didn't want money either. So just looking at me. And eventually he threw his arms around me and he kissed me on the side of the cheek and he whispered in my ear, "That was from your son."
Hmm. What did that do for you, that kiss?
It made me realise, it snapped me out of autopilot. It made me realise that love was everywhere to be found and everywhere in need of me.
That's like a kind of a... It actually happened, but it's like one of those stories you hear from the Middle Ages, that story of a diseased and broken man who nonetheless is possessed of this enormously beautiful thing that he was able to... He's almost like he's sent to you or something like that. He sent himself to you, of course.
Yeah, well...
And he became your friend after
this? Yeah, he became a mate. He's like one of my brothers. He used to ask about my grandchildren every time we met and, you know, we'd... see how much skin he could scratch off his legs and arms and out of his hair. And
You must have loved him, though. You must have loved
him. I adored him. I adored him. He was such a gift to me.
So you held his funeral. What did he die from?
A massive stroke. He was crossing the road just in front of us, actually. And as it happened, there were two nurses walking right behind him. And he hit the footpath and he was gone. And they worked on him, but he was gone. He just absolutely... instant gone. And you know, we held a funeral. It was always our funerals are the most real and beautiful and funny things, and we would generally hold one a week. So you know, that's one way out of King's Cross is in a box. But you know, I did one just recently where a bloke got up and he said "This is my mate." He said he was a good bloke. He taught me everything I needed to know. He taught me how to thieve. He said he even thieved from me, but he was fair. He'd give me half.
You can't say fairer than that, can you?
No.
Right.
No. Quite right.
So, take your $2 and give me one back. That's pretty nice.
Absolutely.
Wow, that's lovely. That's beautiful. So does doing so many of these profound and messy and hilarious funerals give you some idea about how you want your own funeral to be? Was that not up to you? I don't know.
Probably not up to me. My sense is I'm gone at that stage. I just hope somebody's loving Robin and loving my grandchildren and loving my daughter, especially at that time. But I think a wayside funeral would suit me very well. We had this tradition of as the coffin goes out, people often just tap the coffin. It's a bit like a kiss on the way out, and you know that gets a little bit unruly sometimes. And eventually, the coffin gets out into a hearse, and as the hearse drives away, because Hughes Street's only a little street, and it fills with people, and traffic can't get through, and that annoys the traffic, but it doesn't matter. And usually, the street as the coffin pulls away bursts into cheers and screams and applause and you know, for somebody whose life has always been lived at the bottom of the heap, that's a very powerful moment.
I know you love being a grandfather.
I do.
How seriously do you take this grandfathering business, Graham?
What could be more serious? I lay awake at night trying to find new ways to make these kids say wow.
Really?
Right. I seriously do. And I've done all kinds of things. I break rules to a certain extent, just a little
bend them. What kind of rules? Yeah, what rules?
Well, McDonald's isn't their mother's favourite thing. And I was driving with one of my little girls once and I said, "Shall we have lunch, sweetheart?" And she said, "Okay." Mum said, "We can't have McDonald's for lunch." And I said, "Did Mum say we couldn't have a snack at McDonald's?" And she said, "No, Mum didn't say we couldn't have a snack." So we went to McDonald's and we got up to the counter and I said, "What would you like, sweetheart?" She said, "Everything." I said, "I can do that." So I said to the girl behind the thing, "Everything you've got up on your counter here, I want one of." And so we had bags and bags of stuff. We had to ferry to the car. And we went home and we had to ferry it into the house and we're doing relays. And the mother's looking at me like, what kind of grandfather are you? But, you know, I created a memory that kid will never, ever forget. And she thinks her grandfather's the richest bloke in the world and he can do anything. And I love it.
You know, the staff there are trained to upsize you, and you put them in a position where they couldn't upsize you.
They couldn't possibly do it.
Which would probably create a crisis in their souls, I think. You've probably troubled them more than you ever intended to do so. You took them on a helicopter ride recently too.
Yeah, I did. Because I want them to say, well, you know, their birthdays cluster a bit. And it turned out the pilot had been baptized as a kid at Wayside Chapel. So I paid to just go around the Opera House and back, and because of the connection with Wayside, we went up Northern Beaches, and it was terrific. It was just fantastic. Made the kids say, wow, loved it. And you know what? When the helicopter landed, the fellow gave us a DVD. Well, when the helicopter lifted off, we got music, you know, dun, 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 dun. And when you talk to each other, you have to step on a thing on the floor, and you hear each other through headphones because it's really noisy. And the little kids are saying to me, oh, Papa, this is the best birthday ever. And I'm saying back to them, sweetheart, if I had the dough, we would buy this helicopter and take it home. And when we landed and he gave us the DVD, the vision and all of that sound is on the DVD so that they can go home and prove to their friends that their grandfather's the richest bloke in the world.
Drives a Mercedes and has a property marriage.
Owns the Wayside buildings.
Oh, dear. That's glorious. Oh, I'm saying, wow. What a pleasure it is to have you back on. Come back on next year, please, Graven, to share some more stories. There's so many more of them. It's been such a pleasure having you on this program.
It's a pleasure.
Wayside is hosting Sydney's biggest Christmas lunch for the homeless on Christmas Day. There'll be a Christmas service at 10:30 a.m., a huge lunch with all the trimmings, a choir, live entertainment, jumping castle, Santa, dancing in the street for homeless people and for the locals in the King's Cross area. It's the biggest Christmas Day celebration probably in the whole of Australia, I think it's fair to say. And if you want to help, you can donate a plate at the Wayside website. Their website address is waysidechapel.org.au/donateaplate. We'll put that link up on our website as well. And you'll also find my conversation with Graham from 2016 up there too. abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.